Thursday, January 7th, 2021. This is Progressive Development, Episode 3. I'm your host, Grayson Squares. I'm joined by Turner Givens. Turner, how are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you?
Doing well. We're going to get into all of the major news in Major League Baseball here recently. Later in the show, some minor stuff. Astros signing former opener Ryan Stanek, pitcher with the Rays and Miami Marlins. Detroit Tigers signing Robbie Grossman to a two-year contract. But the biggest news today, the New York Mets trading for Francisco Lindor and Carlos Carrasco, sending four prospects to the Cleveland Indians. And Turner, I'll let you hop in and give your thoughts on that major blockbuster first.
I've seen, I don't really have an opinion on it, honestly. Like, I think it's good for both teams. I saw somebody tweet that a rival executive said that it was a steal for the Mets, but Lindor is a free agent after this season, correct?
Correct, yeah.
And they're taking on both contracts, or the majority of both contracts.
All of both contracts.
Okay.
And so, you know, I mean, that seems like the new thing to do in baseball. You know, any team that's trading away salary, we talk about how terrible their ownership is and how they're cheap. And, you know, like, maybe they are cheap, but if you strip away the dollars and cents and you just look at this on a value basis, you know, two players for four players, it's fair value. If we compare it to the Mookie Betts trade from last offseason, Mookie Betts is definitely the better ball player. And, you know, it was a comparable return. So I think that similar to what it was with the Blake Snell trade last episode, I think it's a fair deal that makes sense for both teams.
Yeah, and the Indians did free up a lot of cap space. I mean, what, their payroll's down to $35 million.
Yeah,
now?
It's in the 30s. I think it's the lowest payroll in all of baseball.
I saw that Mike Trout's making more this year than the Indians.
That's,
yeah,
like
the
back
whole Indians
in the
roster. You know, that's crazy.
That's back in the early 2010s when A-Rod was making more than all the Astros, you know. So yeah, but, you know, less on that, more diving into it at a deeper level, because that's what we do here. I guess we'll get into Lindor first, since he's the most major piece involved in the deal. What do you think about Francisco Lindor as a ball player? And I know it's hard to get too negative.
I can't be negative at all. He's a franchise shortstop, right?
Yeah.
I've been kind of doing a little bit. I didn't do a lot of research on him because I know he's been good most, like, his whole career. He's had a couple down years, but his type of down year is still, like, above average.
Right.
He's a stud.
Yeah, he had a down year in 2020. He had a weighted runs created plus of 100, which puts him exactly at league average in run creation. He was directly, that was 13th amongst major league shortstops, by the way. He was directly ahead of Carlos Correa, right behind San Francisco Giants shortstop Brandon Crawford. And that was a really, really down year with the bat for Francisco Lindor. He had a triple slash line of 258, 335, 415. It's well below his career slash line of 288, 347, 493 heading into 2020. But what Lindor still did in 2020 is he brought it with the glove. Tied 8th in defensive runs saved, first in amongst shortstops in UZR. And by the way, with DRS, that was amongst shortstops as well. Second amongst shortstops and outs above average, if you like Baseball Savant and their StatCast stuff. So, you know, even if the bat fails, the glove is still going to be there. And that's huge for the New York Mets because their biggest problem has been defense for quite a while now, or one of their biggest problems. You know, they haven't gotten it done up the middle. They haven't gotten it done in the outfield. JD Davis is their third baseman. Dominic Smith is their left fielder. And so Lindor, at the very least, is going to be an anchor glove in the middle of that infield for the New York Mets.
Yeah, I agree. And they need that, but they also, I'm looking at Lindor's percentile rankings on Baseball Savant, and even though the numbers, his basic stats and slash line didn't match up with the rest of his career, he's still in the red for everything else, which is good on Baseball Savant. Exit velocity percentile was 69%. Hard hit percentage was 60%, which is a little bit, or 60th percentile, sorry. His expected weighted on base average 68th percentile, expected batting average 79th percentile. He didn't strike out and he didn't whiff a lot. He still got it done with the bat. I guess it looks like he got a little unlucky.
So I possibly thought that same thing. I dove into Lindor pretty deeply because, I mean, if you think about it, like, you don't dive into those guys because you know what you're getting, but also he's the biggest investment here. Mm-hmm. So you want to make sure when you're making that big of an investment that you get it right. And so I have here what went wrong in 2020 for Lindor. You know, he had a career high in sweet spot percentage, which is just optimal launch angle. He had a career high in hard hit percentage. His barrel percentage, though, has dipped three consecutive years. In 2018, it was 9.3%. 2019, 7.5%. 2020, about 5.5%. And you mentioned how he doesn't strike out much, but his K percentage in 2020 of 15.4% was actually a career high. He did at least have his second highest walk percentage of his career with that. So while strikeouts went up, his walks went up as well. I think the biggest difference was that Francisco Lindor saw 5% less fastballs in 2020 than he saw in 2019, which was far and away the least fastballs he's ever seen in his career. That was a huge spike in breaking ball percentage that came with it, and he batted 169 against the breaking ball and with a slugging percentage of 322 against it, and his 226 expected batting average and 330 expected slugging percentage against that isn't all that much better. And if you look at how he's performed against the curveball his entire career, Fangraphs has a stat, runs above average against certain pitches. Only 0.6 above average in his entire career, and that includes one massive outlier season in 2017 where he was like 7.5. So he's been below average against the curveball for a vast majority of his career. But here's the thing. In 2020, the season was only 60 games. We saw the league adjust to Frankie. Frankie didn't really have the time to adjust to the league.
Yeah, and I mean, I like that you went and dove into that because you said he's always struggled with the breaking ball, and it looks like the league finally realized, hey, let's throw more breaking balls. And I think that's happening with a lot more hitters is
everyone's spinning it more.
You spin, if you can spin it at a high rate and throw it in the zone and out of the zone, use it a lot because hitters can't hit breaking. It's hard to hit a breaking ball. It moves.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm right there with you. And we talked about that a lot in the last episode as well. And then there's two more aspects that I want to touch on with Lindor. He really got hurt by the shift in 2020. So Lindor's pull percentage increased 3% from 2019, but it's actually up 7% from 2018. So 2 years in a row now, we've seen big spikes in his pull percentage. And he's starting to pull the ball more. He isn't hitting it on the ground to the pull side per se, but since he's hitting it to the pull side, teams are shifting him more. In 2019, he was shifted 32.2% of the time as a left-handed hitter. Remember, he is a switch hitter. He almost never gets shifted from the right-hand side. But in that 32.2% of the time that he was shifted, he had a 369 WOBA against the shift. In 2020, he was shifted 62.6% of the time as a left-handed hitter. And he had a 275 WOBA against the shift. That's a 100-point difference. And by comparison, when he was not shifted as a left-handed hitter in 2020, he had a WOBA of 387. So it looked like the shift really did some damage to him as well, and teams have been able to shift him because he's pulling the ball more.
Okay, so, I mean, it just seems like the story here is teams are starting to adjust to Frankie Lindor.
Pretty much. And, you know, the thing
it
is...
It took him long enough.
Yeah, exactly. It took him long enough. But Lindor's talented enough to adjust back, but it's tough to do that when the season's only 60 games. You know, so I fully expect that Francisco Lindor will come back in 2021 and he'll be spraying the ball around the yard a little bit more. And, you know, we'll see him be the Francisco Lindor of old at the plate.
Yeah, I agree. I think he is very talented and the best in the game make adjustments when they're struggling and get back to their old ways.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point that you made right there. And I'm going to say this, and then we'll get into Carlos Carrasco, get into the pitching end of this. But, you know, Lance Berkman, I'm quoting him real quick, and I'm sure that he stole this from somebody and it wasn't an original thought, and I'm sure tons of people in baseball have heard this before. But average hitters make adjustments day to day. Good hitters make adjustments at bat to at bat. Great hitters make adjustments pitch to pitch. And so Francisco Lindor is a great hitter. He'll make the adjustments and he'll get the job done.
I like that quote.
So moving on to the other big name that the Mets got, to be honest, I mean, this guy shouldn't fly under the radar one bit, and that's Carlos Carrasco. Hop into him because, you know, you're definitely the pitching guy here.
He does fly under the radar, which is unfortunate. He is extremely underrated, and the more and more I went into his numbers, like, it was amazing to think that this guy doesn't get talked about a lot more. He is going to fit into this Mets rotation. He might be okay. You know, if Syndergaard's healthy, Syndergaard could be the number two, right? But he's going to slide in the number two, I think, Carrasco will.
I agree, especially in the short term, since Syndergaard will miss the start of the year, most likely.
Yeah, and I think Carrasco is better than Stroman. better than Lugo. And, you know, I don't know who else they might plug into that spot, but he is, and I'm going to go right into his numbers because I love when I evaluate a pitcher, the first thing I do is go to Baseball Savant and just look at metrics first to see what's going well, what's going wrong. But there's not a lot going wrong for him. His fastball velocity is 57th percentile at about 93.8 to 95 miles an hour. He's spinning the ball 87th percentile at 2470. His curveball spin is 94th at 29, almost 3000, which you don't see a lot of. And then he also throws another breaking ball slider at 2886 miles an hour. So it's a sharp, sharp breaking ball. He throws all these I'm trying to look for the word for it. He commands them well. He doesn't use a curveball a ton, but he gets good results. He uses the slider a lot more than the curveball and gets the same type of results or even better. He K's up guys he's at 77th percentile on K percentage, whip percentage 82nd percentile. So he's at the top of the league in swing and miss type of numbers, right?
Yeah, you've hit the nail on the head. Exactly. And so the thing that stands out the most to me about Carlos Carrasco is his track record of success and consistency. And if we think about the New York Mets, they have lots of guys with track records of success, but not necessarily consistency. And Carlos Carrasco's had one bad season in his career. Like if you look up and down his career, it's been ERAs in the mid threes. Just, you know what you're getting. The only outlier is 2019. He had leukemia, you know, like, he gets a pass. He had cancer. He beat cancer, and he came back to pitch in that year.
And he struck out 96 guys in 80 innings, so he was still striking dudes.
Yeah, he was still missing bats. So another quote that I love, this is my personal trainer here in Houston, Ben Fairchild, trains tons of pro guys, but I've heard him say multiple times, you know, the greatest ability is availability. And the Mets have a lot of guys like Syndergaard, who is injured all the time. Zach Wheeler, before he went to the Phillies, was injured all the time. With Marcus Stroman, I mean, he missed all of 2020 with an injury and opting out because of COVID. Like, we'll give him a little bit of pass for that, but he's had injury concerns in his career, and he's also had performance peaks and valleys in his career. And so Carlos Carrasco for the Mets is just exactly what they need. He's just going to be steady in that 2 or 3 spot in the rotation. Like you said, he misses a ton of bats. He fits that mold that we've talked about throughout the first two episodes of above average velo, above average spin. And there is one question that I want to ask you, though. He did start to have a little bit of a walk problem in 2020.
I noticed that.
It went from 4.7% in 2019 to 9.6% in 2020. It had never been higher than 5.9% in his career. Is that something that you're concerned about in the slightest bit or not really?
I don't think so, especially with it being, if it was a full season and we saw an issue with command, then there would be an issue there. But, you know, I haven't really taken things too seriously with the 2020 season being short. I just think, you know, it might be a blip and he gets back to his old ways. But if he does start to walk guys at a higher rate, he can get away with that because he has that swing and miss stuff. So like that's, if you don't have swing and miss stuff and you walk guys, you're at risk of being hit around a little bit more. So,
and he was in 2019. Like, it was a career low walk rate, but like, he got hit hard a lot.
Yeah.
And then in 2020, you know, yeah, he was walking more guys, but he was missing plenty of bats and making up for it.
Oh yeah. And his, I mean, all the hitting metrics versus him are averaging around 65th percentile. So he's still at the top of the league, and he's not just, you know, spinning the ball well, throwing it hard and missing bats here and there. He's consistently missing bats. And even when people are making contact, they're not hitting the ball hard. So that is extremely, that's a good sign. And you mentioned already, he's been consistent his whole career. He had one blip, and, you know, we definitely give him the benefit of the doubt having leukemia. Like, that's a big step to overcome in a season, and he still had it.
Yeah, I mean, like, that's worse than Tommy John, if you want, like, that's, yes, worse than 100%. Torn Achilles for Mike Soroka. Like, you know, I mean, pick any injury ever. Like, this dude had cancer, you know, and he beat it and came back and played in the same season.
That's something you don't know if you're coming back from.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, Tommy John, you're at least going to have a chance to rehab, right? But in his situation, he didn't know, but he bounced back and had an incredible 2020, and I think he's going to keep going. He's 33 years old. So he's starting to age a little bit, but he knows how to pitch and he's a smart pitcher. So even if the velocity starts to drop, even if the spin starts to drop, I think he knows how to pitch and can get away. He can get away with more things than a younger guy that hasn't really found their true identity, who has the same type of stuff.
Yeah. And this is my last thought on the return for the Mets, and then we'll get into what the Indians got. But if we think about what the two biggest issues with the Mets have been in recent history, in my opinion, it's been one, defense, and two, injuries. From Cespedes to Cano to Syndergaard to Wheeler, and you could just keep on going. Brandon Nimmo's been injured. You know, David Wright, look at how his career ended. And they got two guys that play every single day, and you know what you're getting. And Francisco Lindor is going to play a great defense and help that defense up the middle. He played all 60 games in 2020. I don't have his games played up in front of me, but I just know off of reputation, he's not a guy that spends time on the injured list. And we just said that same thing about Carlos Carrasco. So they got two guys that are dependable, and they got two guys that fill needs for them.
Yeah, they both seem like really good clubhouse guys too. I mean, I haven't heard any negative things said about Lindor or Carrasco.
Everyone loves those two. I mean, Francisco Lindor's nickname, Mr. Smile. You know, like, how do you hate that guy? So, all right, going on to the Indians' return. I guess we'll touch on Amed Rosario first, since he has the longest major league track record. So, Amed Rosario, he was the number 11 ranked prospect in all of MLB in 2016. He was the number one prospect in the Mets system, and he debuted in 2017. And the bottom line stats say he hasn't quite lived up to that prospect billing. But what do you think about Amed Rosario?
He can burn. He's fast.
That's definitely very his best fast. Tool.
What is he, 92nd percentile in sprint speed, and it hasn't really fluctuated throughout his career, if I'm correct?
Yeah, ever. It's always been 90.
It's slowly gone down, but not by much. I'm looking at it right now. Like people are getting, so that's the thing too, is if people get faster, your percentile is going to go down a little bit, right? He doesn't hit the ball as well as you would like him to, but he can run, and he's got potential, I would say. So I think I went to 2019. He had a way better 2019 than 2020. And that seems like to be the case for a lot of guys this past year. There are a lot of distractions, but he had a way better 2019. He was way better expected batting average. I think it was 91st percentile compared to 2020, where he had 28th percentile. So a giant jump. And then we go to K percentage was 67th. So he was able to handle the bat. He doesn't walk a ton, but he didn't strike out a ton in 2019 either.
Yeah, no, he has really good hand-eye coordination. Like, he puts the bat on the baseball. There's just not a lot of damage being done when he puts that bat on the baseball. And, you know, you said you didn't walk much. I mean, that's understating it. His walk percentage in 2020 was 2.7%.
Mm-hmm.
But what I put here is I think Cleveland's buying him at the right time. So I dove in and looked at his video probably longer than I looked at anyone else that we're going to discuss today. And you mentioned in 2019 he had his best season offensively, and he did. I mean, his expected batting average was 290-something, which was in the top, you know, 10 percentile in the league. You know, just hit much better in 2019. And in 2020, his exit velo dropped 3 miles per hour. His launch angle cut in half. But when I look at his swing on video, in 2019, he never had a consistent base swing. He had three different loads. There were times where he toe-tapped. There was times where there was no stride. There was times where he had a normal stride. There was times where he started super late and his timing was off, but he's just quick and twitchy enough where he threw his hands and got a good result. There was times where he was way early and he's, you know, lunging out at the baseball. And in 2020, he started off by doing that exact same thing. But in September, he only leg kicked, except for sometimes with two strikes. He would do a no stride and cut down on a swing. Like, there was an at bat against Max Scherzer where he cut down, which I understand, you know? But for the most part, it was a consistent leg kick, consistent timing. And in September, Amed Rosario hit 366, 409, 463. So that's a totally different hitter. And then last point on him, he's been a defensive disaster in his career despite the athleticism. Minus 35 defensive runs saved, minus 4.2 UZR. But in 2020, he started to pick it up with the glove. Plus one UZR, 92nd percentile on outs above average. His DRS was still below average, if I'm remembering correctly, but it was much better. And so his glove is starting to come around. It looked like his bat was starting to come around, and it looks like that Cleveland might have bought him at the right time.
Yeah, and this is a question that I have for you, and I've been thinking about it a little bit. So we see like inconsistencies with hitters on the offensive side. So it's like, oh, he had a great year, but that was just lucky. Can you get lucky defensively?
Some of it, I think it is. You know, I mean, that's an interesting thing to think about. I definitely don't have a firm answer for you that I'm confident in. I think the lucky versus unlucky. I mean, yeah, we talk about like getting bad hops and all that, you know, and I don't think we have a statistical way to be like, oh, that was a bad hop, you know? I think you can get lucky in whether you just get a run of routine balls hit right at you. And then then you end up with six plays in a row where you're diving all over the place. So like that's the luck aspect of it. And that's impossible to quantify. But also, don't go from being negative 35 defensive run save to being average, you know, without huge improvement.
Yeah, I feel like you have more. It's more likely for you to be lucky as a hitter. The dominoes fall the right way. But defensively, like that seems it just to me. It seems like something that he wasn't lucky this year. Like he actually made some big strides and improvements on his defensive game. And hopefully it sticks. And I think, you know what, now it's starting to roll a little bit. I think the Indians saw that, like you said, they bought him at the right time. They saw that he made some changes defensively, and now they're like, okay, let's work with the bat.
And even if we want to go into outs above average as well, and the reason I use that last defensively is because people aren't quite on board with it being totally accurate, but he was bottom 10 percentile in 19 and 18, and I think in 17 as well. And in 2020, 92nd percentile and outs above average. And again, like the stat might not be perfectly accurate, but you don't go from one of the worst in the league to one of the best in the league without making improvement.
Yeah, I agree. I think you see that a lot more with defense than offense. Cause you know, offensively, so defensively you might get a string of, like you said, routine ground balls, or you might get some bad hops. So those are the two extremes on each side, but hitting, like, I feel like you can just get lucky and have a couple bloop singles, barrel a couple up, and, you know, pitchers don't pitch you the right way for some reason, and you have a decent year. But then when guys figure you, there's no, like, pitchers can't get a scouting report on your defense because that has nothing to do with it, right?
Yeah.
Like, pitchers dictate your offensive success. You dictate your defensive success, right?
Yeah, absolutely. 100%. And like you said, you know, the only time you're going to target someone on the defense is if they're the third baseman, you know, we know he struggles handling bunts, or the first baseman struggles handling bunts. And look at, you know, they don't do that in Major League Baseball. They just don't. Like, those guys are professionals. They all play good defense. So, like, everyone makes the routine plays. And, you know, that's more of a college high school thing where, like, hey, you know, this guy's not an athlete at third, and, you know, let's lace him down or kind of poke some over there and see if he can handle it. That's not the case in professional baseball. So it really is, you know, you versus yourself defensively, just being locked in mentally, being positioned correctly, and it's not really a luck factor. Like, that's skill through and through for the most part.
Yeah.
So the next guy that the Mets got, Andrés Giménez, he's the other guy that has major league experience out of the four players that the Indians got in return, the Indians got in return. Heading into 2019, Andrés Giménez was the number 3 ranked prospect in the New York Mets top 30. He was number 92 in the MLB top 100. He debuted this year in the shortened 2020. And what I saw in Giménez, open stance, leg kick, does a really good job of getting into hip coil. I'd like to see him get more linear. He can get a little hippie and stuck on his backside, and he's really pull happy. And what I thought, you could tell me if you thought the same thing, I thought he was kind of a similar profile to Ahmed Rosario, but just hits from the left side instead of the right.
Yeah, I was thinking the exact same thing. Just like on the outside, the numbers are almost the same. The sprint speed's very similar. Outs above average, very similar. They don't strike out too much, but, you know, they can burn. They're both extremely fast. They both have fairly good back control. I think, would you say Jimenez has better back control than Rosario?
I would say so.
Okay, that's what I noticed. I don't watch it. When we do these breakdowns, I don't watch a ton of hitting videos because I don't want to sound like an idiot for part of them. Yeah. So I let you run with those, but I did watch his stuff, and I mean, he's athletic, and he seems like he has really good back control and hand-eye coordination.
Yeah, agreed. And that was the big thing on Jimenez coming up was puts the bat on the baseball, and there has never been questions about his glove. And that's why I think his hand-eye is a little bit better than Rosario, because we saw Rosario booted around for a few years before figuring it out defensively. But I think Jimenez is just maybe a little bit more coordinated, a little bit better of an athlete, because he's always been a vacuum cleaner defensively, and he's always been able to put the bat on the ball offensively.
Yeah, he's a small guy too. Do you see him gaining any pop, or does he have a chance to have pop in that swing?
He's got some sneaky pop pull side. You know, like, I mean, he can put the ball out of the ballpark, you know, 10, 15 times a year. But he's definitely going to be glove first, speedy, scrappy. And here's what I think that the Indians are doing, and you can tell me if you agree. And there's always this old, you know, adage in baseball of, you know, pitching defense and timely hitting wins championships. And what it seems like the Indians are doing to me is they have all of these, you know, they have this elite pitching staff, even with Carlos Carrasco out the door now, led by Shane Bieber. And they've always believed in their ability to develop pitching. So you know that they're going to have pitching. Defensively, if Rosario's improvement is legit and Jimenez is already a great defender, you know you have two great defenders up the middle at shortstop and second base. Center field's still an issue for them. But I think that they're really going that direction, and they're just going to get some scrappy hitters that put the bat on the ball, that don't strike out, and that's the timely hitting aspect of it.
Yeah, they're going to be a younger team, and you mentioned this probably 3-4 weeks ago when we were talking about Lindor possibly being traded. You wanted to see the Indians go fill up the middle of the field with solid defense. And
Austin Hedges behind the plate too. I just forgot him. He's the best defensive catcher.
They're on their way there. Mm-hmm. They're one piece away, I would say.
Yeah, they're center field away, which still, go get Kevin Kiermaier, Cleveland. Like, your payroll's $35 million. You can afford that contract.
That's a question. Before we get to the next two guys in this trade, do you think, so their payroll's tiny now, Are they going to keep, you know, going for trades? Are they going to go, you think they go for a big name free agent, or you think they're kind of holding off?
They're not going to go for a big name free agent. There's definitely room to add payroll there. Like, there's no way the Cleveland Indians go into 2021 with a $35 million payroll. So I think that they spend some money on a center fielder. I don't think it's a big name. I think it's, you know, whether it's trading for someone like Kevin Kiermaier and paying $12 million, or signing someone like Jackie Bradley Jr. and paying $9 million. I really think that's the direction that they're going with. They just want to have elite defense up the middle, and they're going to develop their arms the way that they do, and they're going to hope that that's enough to win in that division and get them into the playoffs.
And they can definitely develop arms. I don't think their staff really takes that much of a drop from losing Carrasco.
I don't know. And that's the thing is, you know, the Cleveland is just as good at this player development thing as the Tampa Bay Rays are. And we both got on our soapbox with the Rays last week, and Cleveland is just as good.
And they were probably the ones that kind of, I mean, there's a lot of teams that kicked it off, but the Indians have been developing pitchers for a while. And they,
going back to CeCe Sabathia and Cliff Lee, you know, I mean, yeah. Going back to the mid-2000s, think about a time since 2005, where the Indians haven't had an ace in their rotation. They've always had at least one, sometimes two, sometimes three.
Yeah, this rotation, it looks like right now you got Bieber, Plesac, McKenzie, possibly. Is it Quantrill and Savali?
Yeah, that's probably what they're going to roll with if I had to guess. And all of those guys are good names. You know, again, Bieber just won the Cy Young.
Mm-hmm.
We don't need to touch on him after that. Plesac, say what you want about him as a human being after what he did in 2020 with COVID. The guy shoves. His uncle pitched in the big leagues. There's bloodlines there. You know, Quantrill, his dad pitched in the big leagues. There's bloodlines there. He's been a top-rated prospect. He was at least considered to go in the first round. I can't remember when he was picked. I'm actually going to look that up real quick. Tristan McKenzie's been a top 100 prospect, and Aaron Savali's just been one of those guys that has, you know, performed way better than anyone expected him to. You know,
he's an underrated guy too.
Yeah, that's just Cleveland doing their job of player development.
He's another outlier because I think him and Sonny Gray are the only two guys in the major leagues with them. They both had the most. Oh man, I wish I remembered it. It was some type of movement profile, I think, on their fastball. And I think it was maybe the most difference between their fastball and breaking ball movements, like separation. But Kenzie's another guy that has electric stuff and he only weighs 165 pounds.
Yeah. He's
if he puts on some weight, he might be pumped. He's pumping, I think, 94, 95, and he's like 6'5, 165 pounds. If he puts on some weight, this guy might be sitting upper nines with, I mean, he can zip it in there.
Yeah. And going back to Quantrill, I just looked it up. Eighth overall pick in the draft in 2016. So I think there were concerns, if I'm remembering correctly, there were concerns that he was going to fall because he needed Tommy John surgery. He missed his whole first professional season. But, I mean, those concerns meant he fell to eight. So, obviously, there's some talent there.
100%.
And so getting into did you get into Isaiah Green at all, the next guy involved in the deal, or not really?
I did. Young kid. I mean, I couldn't really find, it's tough to find swings and, you know, video of guys pitching, like all these young prospects. It's tough to find video sometime, but I mean, he was drafted in 2020. So there's a reason why he was picked up. He's a young guy. They said his high school stats really didn't jump off the page, but they saw a lot of raw talent in area code games. He can run.
He's 6'4", 860.
Yeah. Plus speed. Said he needs to polish up his routes and his reads in the outfield, but you know, when you have speed, you can make up bad reads with the speed. He's aggressive on the bases, solid hand-eye coordination, just not a lot of pop. He's raw right now.
Yeah, so I drafted in the second round in 2020, and I read a tweet earlier today, maybe from Jonathan Mayo, one of those types, that said that that Cleveland was a big fan of him as well, and so they had their eye on him. The Mets just snagged him first. Hasn't played a lick of pro ball yet because of COVID. I did find some video of his swing just in batting practice, not in game. He sways into his load. He has some negative movement, which is fine. I don't have any negative movement in my swing. I just prefer it that way. If I were a hitting instructor teaching hitters, you know, I mean, if that's the way that they have to get in their load, that's fine. It's just not the way that I would teach it. I like to, you know, I like to see guys gain ground, get towards the baseball. He has a front arm bar. Where his arm gets locked out real early and his bat is kind of slow through the zone, and it causes him to pull out his front side in order to create room to get his backside through. But he gets into hip coil well. Basically, if I were his hitting instructor, you know, I would just tell him, you know, get your back elbow to your belly button so we can get you on plane sooner, and that'll keep him from barring that front arm out and getting and letting his swing get long.
I was reading too that you can attest to this. He has a flatter bat path.
He does. He has a very flat bat path. And this gets into what we were talking about with Rosario and Jimenez. Like those are two other guys that put the bat on the ball, don't swing and miss a lot, you know, gap to gap line drive contact. And that's what Isaiah Green is right now. Now he's 19 years old, 18 years old. He very well could become a different type of hitter, but right now he's a line drive gap to gap contact hitter. And so again, like that's another guy that doesn't have a lot of swing and miss, scrappy, runs well, athlete. That really looks like the profile that Cleveland was going for with these position players.
Yeah, and you mentioned the arm bar thing, and I know what you're talking about, and I'm just thinking as a like a movement on the movement side of things, that seems like an issue that it's gonna keep him from moving like the way his body wants to move. Like
he's not moving optimally. He's not moving optimally one bit right now as a hitter.
Yeah, I mean, in the fact that he got drafted in, you said the second round or third round?
Second round.
So if he's got all, he's so raw, but he's still so talented there's upside, big upside.
Tons of upside. And Cleveland's player development is so good that I would bet on them to get the most out of him.
Yeah.
So this probably excites you because we're finally going to get into a pitcher on the prospect side. Josh Wolf, the last prospect we're going to touch on. Both Turner and I are Houston kids. Josh Wolf went to St. Thomas High School here in Houston, so he's a local kid. I actually faced Josh Wolf in high school. I got one at-bat, two at-bats against him. But what did you see on Josh Wolf before I give you
how those at-bats go, first of all?
One for one with a walk.
Was he lighting it up at 97 at
not,
that point?
Not then. So he was a freshman when I was a senior, so he had, like,
Okay.
He goes to the same gym that I do, too. This is a story that I hope I'm not going to get in trouble for telling this story. But one of the trainers was actually telling me this today because of the trade happened. When Josh Wolf went in there in eighth grade, he had the worst external rotation of any active athlete that they had. And they're like, dude, like, you've got to shut it down and, like, stop throwing and, you know, like, get some therapy because you're going to get injured. And he's just like, no, and didn't listen to him. And they're like, okay, well, if you don't want to listen to us, like, I guess that's fine. But, you know, maybe like, explore options, go elsewhere, like, because we want people here that, you know, that want to listen to us. And the next thing we know, you know, his freshman year, he's on varsity, like, sitting 86. And then his sophomore year, he's sitting 96 and committed to the University of Texas or Texas A&M, whatever it was. But, yeah, that was the progression of Josh Wolf. So when I saw Josh, he was, like, 84 to 86 and on their varsity. And, you know, we played St. Thomas. And, yeah, I got a single off of him in my first at-bat and then walked in my second one.
Yeah, he's still skinny. I watched video of him today.
Very
6'3", 170. So he's got to be, you know, high, quick twitch muscle fibers. You can't throw hard unless you have some type of elasticity where you can rip it forward. He pitched in the GCL. Was it this year? Maybe last year.
In 19, because there was no 19. Minor leagues this year.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. So rookie league, I mean, 3.38 ERA, eight innings pitched, 9 hits, 12 Ks. I did go and look at a little bit more details on that, and he struck out 36% of the batters he faced and 42% swinging strike rate at that level. So I know it was only 8 innings of sample size, but he got a ton of whiffs. He throws 97 plus. He's got a extremely sharp 12-6 breaking ball that I did notice on video. Sometimes he backs it up a little bit because he doesn't stay on top of it. But it sits about low eights. Changeup is but you know, I don't know if I've said it yet, but that is the most common issue with young pitchers is changeups. It's such a feel pitch and you need a lot of time to throw it and experiment with it that young high school guys, even college guys, seem to have an issue with finding their changeup.
Yeah, I can name one teammate that I had that like had a really good changeup before they got to their junior year of college, you know. So I was teammates with Jared Pettit in high school, Andy Pettit's son. And Jared had a heck of a changeup, and that feel probably just comes from, you know, his dad was a borderline Hall of Fame, if not future Hall of Fame pitcher. But aside from that, like, I can't really think of anyone that, like, when they were in high school had a good feel for their changeup, or even when they were a freshman or sophomore in college had a good feel for their changeup. But it really is one of those pitches that you've just got to throw it, and you've got to learn to trust it.
Yeah, and Josh Wolf is going to find success with just a fastball and breaking ball. Changeup, if it's there, it's there. I watch his mechanics, clean mechanics. Super explosive at the last second. So, I mean, right when he lands, everything whips forward. He moves fast, stays tall, stays balanced, doesn't have any lean. He stays very, very linear to the plate. Good direction. And I almost got a Verlander-esque kind of feel from watching his video. Like, he's, you know, have you seen Verlander pitch? He's very straight up and down, stays balanced really well, doesn't have any misdirections. The arm path. Did you watch Wolf at all?
Yeah, I watched his video. And the same thing stood out to me just in much simpler terms is just that his mechanics were so simple. It was just straight north and south, straight towards home. You know, it's not a big human being coming at you because he weighs 170 pounds, but all 170 pounds is coming at you.
Yeah, and no wasted movement either. Like he's using his whole body, but it doesn't look like he's trying to use his whole body. Like
easy
it wasn't
guess.
He's yank and tug and see, like, pull my arm through and I got to do what I got to do because I only weigh 170 pounds. He's just super consistent and very efficient with his mechanics, which allows him to be, it looks smooth.
Yeah. And that's why I would bet on him to pan out because his time developing with coaches isn't going to be fixing mechanics. It isn't going to be, you know, like, hey, let's have a session where we just get, you know, get your body aligned and we don't care where the ball's going. All of his bullpen sessions, for the most part, there might be minor mechanical tweaks here and there, but all of his bullpen sessions, for the most part, are going to be feel of pitches, execution of location, and those guys are going to advance and be ready to help you out so much quicker than those guys that need the mechanical help.
100%. I think they, you know, they're probably going to try to put some weight on him. Hopefully that doesn't change his movement profile and his mechanics, you know, if he becomes a tighter mover, if his mechanics change, I don't know what's going to happen. But like you said, he's going to be in the bullpen and in games focusing on pitch development, like just learning and finding his identity as a pitcher, command, pitch design, change of feel, knowing what he does really well, knowing where to throw certain pitches, what to do in certain situations. So it helps when you're really good at one area, because you don't have to put as much, you still have to train that area, but you don't have to put your main focus on that.
Right. It's all maintenance for that area. It's not overhaul. And that makes it so much easier to develop, because then those areas of your game that you do need to overhaul, that's where you're spending your time.
Yeah. And he's young too, right? 20 years old.
High school kid. So,
So I mean, I like this return that the Indians got for sure.
Yeah, I do as well. And so that was the Francisco Lindor and Carlos Carrasco trade to the New York Mets. Four pieces going back to the Cleveland Indians. We touched on all of them. Both Turner and I think that it's a good deal for both teams. Moving on to two more minor transactions that have happened this week. The Tigers, sticking with the Houston theme for all of them, by the way. The Tigers signed Robbie Grossman, 2 years, $10 million. He's born and raised just outside Houston here in the Cypress area. What do you think of Robbie Grossman?
He was a perfect role player for the Astros when he was in his career, right?
Yeah, he was a prospect that the Astros brought up. Kind of struggled with Houston and got waived, and then the Minnesota Twins.
I always liked him. I know he did struggle with the Astros, but it was in a situation where, I mean, what years were that? I can't remember off the top of my head.
14, 15, 16, you know, and that right when they were getting into those playoff years.
13, 14, 15. So, like, yeah, he was right on the cusp of the success with the Astros, but he's always, it looks like throughout his career, he's always been a guy that gets on base. That seems to be the theme of his approach at the plate.
Absolutely. Yeah. Walks a ton. That was less consistent at the beginning of his career. And again, A.J. Hinch is the manager now in Detroit, so Robbie Grossman is playing for his old manager again. But the big thing with Grossman had a terrible 2016. He had minus 35 or minus 20-something, minus 20 defensive runs saved in left field in 2016 for the Minnesota Twins. He was below average in walk percentage, below average in strikeout percentage, and he really just remade himself in 2017. And so my favorite part about Robbie Grossman before we get into the hitting is his defense. Comerica Park with the Detroit Tigers play, it's the ninth largest outfield in MLB by square footage. It's a very big outfield, and so they need sprinkler heads out there that can go get the baseball. And Grossman, three defensive runs saved in 2019, minus two in 2020, which, you know, minus two, short season, you know, yada, yada. We've said that a bunch. But he was positive in left field in 2019. And the fact that he was even able to get to where he's a positive out there when he was negative 20 4 years before is pretty incredible. And going on from there, too, 3.7 UZR in 19, 0.1 in 2020. Going to the StatCast statistics from Baseball Savant, 80th percentile in outfield jump in 2019, 74th percentile in outs above average, 70th percentile in outfield jump in 2020, 94th percentile in outs above average. So, I mean, he's really turned himself into a good defender out there.
Yeah, and he runs above average. He's 66th percentile in sprint speed, but he makes up for maybe that lack in raw speed with his outfield jump and his ability to go get the ball and read the ball. So, defensively, I mean, it's both sides, but yes, I would say he's more of a defensive guy than an offensive guy, but he gets on base too, which is going to be, it doesn't matter what his batting average is, his on base percent, his career on base percentage has been 350.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What I wanted to say about his hitting part too, and with AJ Hinch becoming the manager of the Detroit Tigers, I am kind of looking for them to start going the Astros mold a little bit, because I think he's going to have some influence there. And when you think about the Houston Astros hitters, in 2015, the Houston Astros were, I think, led baseball in strikeouts, and they lost to the Royals in the playoffs, who went on to win the World Series. And Jeff Luhnow and A.J. Hinch and the management over there went all in on saying, we're not striking out like that ever again. And if you look at the Astros lineup in recent years, Alex Bregman walks a ton, doesn't swing and miss. Michael Brantley walks a ton, doesn't swing and miss. George Springer, when he first came up to the big league, swung and missed a lot. Now, George Springer doesn't swing and miss, walks a bunch. Yuli Gurriel, he doesn't walk at all, but he doesn't swing and miss. And so there's not a lot of swing and miss in the Astros lineup, and Robbie Grossman's going to bring that to the Detroit Tigers. He doesn't swing and miss. He's above average in strikeout percentage. He's above average in walk percentage. And while he might not light up StatCast, Alex Bregman doesn't light up StatCast. Jose Altuve doesn't light up StatCast. And so I do find it intriguing that the Tigers hire A.J. Hinch, and then the first hitter that they bring on is a hitter directly out of the Astros mold.
Yeah, he fits right into that system perfectly, right? And he's going to benefit other players, too, that they need to get into that system. So it's not just going to be Hinch and the rest of the coaching staff helping. It's going to be other players like Robbie Grossman. I mean, he's a cheap sign, too. Was he about a million, too?
I think it's $5 million a year, but the second year is a team option. But you gave me a perfect segue into my next point about Robbie Grossman, and I think you'll find this to be really cool. Robbie Grossman is a switch hitter. And you talked about him being able to mentor the younger hitters on the team and being able to help them out with fitting into that Astros mold. Robbie Grossman is a switch hitter. That's not very common. The Detroit Tigers, Willy Castro, Heimer Candelario, Nico Goodrum, Victor Reyes, Sergio Alcantara, and Robbie Grossman, all on their 40-man roster, all switch hitters, and all of them but Alcantara will probably be in their opening day lineup.
That's awesome. That's going to be part of those guys. And those are all young. I don't know if he's significantly older than them.
He's 31. All those guys, you know, haven't hit arbitration yet. So regardless of where they are in age, whether they be 20 or whether they be 26, you know, they don't have a lot of years playing in the big leagues under their belt.
Yeah. He's a perfect mentor for him too. So that's money. That's perfect.
Six switch hitters on their 40-man roster. That's pretty incredible. That gives them some lineup flexibility as well.
That's a smart move because, you know, Tigers aren't going to compete this year, but they're not that far away. They got a really good young core that I think that, if they get a couple arms in the next couple years, we're looking at a very similar situation to the Astros.
They've got a stable of arms on the way with Casey Mize and Tarik Skubal and Matt Manning and Franklin Perez and Alex Lange and, you know, Kyle Funkhauser debuted this year. I mean, they've got just options upon options upon options on the pitching end. And now on the hitting end, too, you know, Willy Castro had a really good debut in 2020. Isak Paredes is a guy that they like. They just drafted Spencer Torkelson with the first overall pick. They got two other good college performers in Dylan Dingler and Daniel Cabrera from NC State and LSU, catcher and outfielder. I mean, the Tigers are on their way to being a really good team sooner than later.
And they're probably not going to dip into the free agent market this year, but you know, if they feel comfortable where they're at next year, they could try to spend a little bit of money. What do you think?
I agree. And so I wrote this note down too, again, giving a Houston tie. So in 2013, the Astros were the worst team in baseball. 2014, they traded for Dexter Fowler, and they took a big step forward. They finished 72-90, and that was A.J. Hinch's first season as Astros manager. It was 2014. And so Robbie Grossman kind of feels like this team's Dexter Fowler, where he's that older guy who's a leader, who's going to start leading them from being one of the worst teams in baseball, if not the worst team in baseball, to being respectable. And then remember 2015 when the Astros finally made the playoffs. Scott Feldman, they brought in 14 as well. But yeah. 15, they brought in, who'd they bring in? They made the midseason trades for Kazmir and Gomez, but they made some other moves as well. Finally, in 2015, the Astros started to spend.
Talk about Fires.
Yeah, right. Mike Fires is in that trade. Robbie Grossman feels like that first piece that the Tigers are spending for, similar to that Dexter Fowler was the first piece that the Astros made an investment in. Robbie Grossman is their 14 piece, for the Tigers is 2020-21, and then 2022 is their year where, okay, we think that we can really make the playoffs and make a push now.
Yeah. Robbie Grossman and Miguel Cabrera seem like perfect guys to mesh in the clubhouse and to pull these young guys forward.
I agree. And so speaking about the Astros as much as we have, they've made their first move of the offseason. James Click really, he traded for Brooks Raley. That was his first major move. But we'll call this his second major move of his tenure, signing Ryan Stanek. Hop into it.
He had a tough 2020, but this seems to be a very, very common theme that you can't judge him off of 2020. 7.20 ERA, 10 innings pitch, 11 Ks, but he was 9th in percentile in walks. It was awful. 16.7% of the time he was walking guys.
Yeah, up from 10.3% in 2018. Like, it really just looks like he forgot where home plate is.
Yeah, I mean, and even those numbers, like 10% isn't great, but it's not terrible. He's going to be a guy who walks guys more often because of his delivery. He's got a funky delivery over the top. He tilts off the ball, but he throws hard. I mean, he throws 96 miles an hour. He spins the ball 2,300. he throws a hard slider at 88 to 90. He throws a hard splitter 88 to 90. But yeah, that was the theme this year, was he just didn't know where the ball was going. This is crazy, but his fastball command in 2019, he also has 99% spin efficiency, so he's getting true ride on his fastball. He lived up in the zone. I'd say belt high and higher. He used the middle of the plate, but up. In 2020, that shifted to about belt high, or I think it was a little bit lower than belt high, and middle to middle away. So his fastball shifted in a dangerous spot. His slider, I'm looking at red contour spots all over the zone with the slider in 2020. His splitter has a red, it's a deep red circle in the middle of this, like literally middle. If you look on Baseball Savant, it's going to be middle. In 2019, he spotted up off like knee high and down. And he threw that, and that's what you have to do with your splitter, is throw it knee high and down, because it has so much depth, it has so much drop, because you can get away with missing low because it looks like a strike later because of all the depth that a splitter has. But he's throwing muffins with his splitter. So this is a good pickup for the Astros because we know they can develop pitchers. I don't think they're going to make a ton of changes mechanically. Strom makes changes that are very subtle. So to get his direction in a better place or get his command better, he makes some small changes. But he has the metrics that the Astros love to see, and I think he's going to be a perfect guy to have in the back end of the bullpen.
What really stands out to me about what you said just now, because it fits into what we've talked about this off the mic before. You know, the way the game's trending is overpowering velo and huge spin. And then James Click coming over from the Tampa Bay Rays, and I want to note that Stanek was with the Rays while Click was there as an executive, so there is a level of familiarity there. And we both speculated that Click would probably go get one of those Rays cast-offs, that just doesn't quite fit in there anymore because they have so many arms, whether that have been Chaz Rowe or Oliver Drake, Aaron Loop. This time it was someone who's been out of Tampa Bay for a little bit, and Stanek. And funky looks. We said that the thing that we think that James Click was going to adopt from Tampa Bay, was the funky looks part. We said the Astros already have overpowering spin. They already have overpowering velo, but it feels like all their guys are throwing from the same release point. And you said Stanek, a little bit of a funky delivery from a unique release point.
Yeah, he tilts off of a little bit. I don't have exact like extension numbers or anything on him, but I would say he's not Oliver Drake. He's not to that extreme, but he's an outlier in release. But if he's not extremely an outlier in release, he throws 96 miles an hour, can throw it up in the zone, throws a hard slider, throws a hard splitter. Like everything moves. Everything he throws moves. Now he just needs to bring the command in. And if he can get back to that 10% walk rate, even 12% walk rate, that will help him.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm right there with you. 2020, 16.7% walk rate, like we've said. His strikeout percentage from 2018, I brought up that 10.3% walk percentage in 2018. His strikeout percentage has dropped 8% about in that same time frame. So that's really concerning when your walks spike and your strikeouts drop. That's not a good combo. But I guess what is assuaging if you're an Astros fan is his bad to ball quality against hasn't changed. Like, hitters aren't hitting him any better now than they were then. It's just that he puts guys on base, and that's really hard to be successful when you're putting him on base for free at a 16% clip.
Yeah, that command is definitely an issue. And he's got even when his command struggles, like he was missing over the plate with his fastball. Guys are going to slug him a little bit more. He's going to throw up in the zone. He throws hard. That happens to Verlander, happens to to Cole, happens to Grom, even though he's almost untouchable. Like, if you throw hard, making contact, the ball is going to go farther. So he's still successful with his, with those two, his fastball, but to get, to make him more successful, he's definitely got to go back to his old ways of 2019, 2018 of living a little bit more up in the zone and being able to elevate it and command it and not miss glove side over, I mean, belt high and to the knees. Like, that's a spot that hitters can hit.
Yeah, I agree with you. And here's another, I guess, reason for optimism with Ryan Stanek is even in 2019, while we can't get splits for the specific numbers that we're talking about with pitch contours and location and stuff, he was with the Rays the first half of that season, got traded at the deadline to the Marlins, and he was much better with the Rays before getting traded to the Marlins. And while the Marlins did have a great 2020, and I think the Marlins are on the right trajectory and that they're going to be really good soon, I think Derek Jeter and company is doing a great job over there. They're not as advanced as the Tampa Bay Rays, and the Houston Astros are. And so I think getting back into that advanced environment that he's used to might help him a little bit. And then lastly, this is more from the Astros perspective, Ryan Stanek was the first ever person to be used as an opener and was really used a lot as an opener with the Tampa Bay Rays. And that's something that gives the Astros an option of if they want to use the opener a little bit more often, they have a guy that's familiar with it.
Yeah, I did. I was reading that he wants an opportunity to pitch high leverage situations. So that doesn't necessarily mean back end of the bullpen. That means, I mean, if you need to be high leverage for the first inning of the game, then you got to do that. Or middle of the game, end of the game, he just wants to pitch high leverage situations and he has the stuff to do that. It's, I think, like you said, I think it was a situation of the system. Like, he was really good with the race system because they're so much more advanced than the Marlins. And I think the Marlins, they may have not used him right. I didn't go in enough detail to see if they used him correctly, but it seems like once he gets into the Astros systems, I trust in King Strom to clean him up.
King Strom, that guy, it's got to be, if he's not the highest paid pitching coach in baseball, I don't know who is, but that man needs to get a paycheck.
He's a guru.
Yeah, he really knows his stuff. All right, so I think we've covered at least all the moves that we planned on going over. Do you have anything left that you want to touch on, or do you think we got it all?
I think we got it all. I hope there's some more blockbuster trades and, you know, big signings coming up soon. There definitely will be big signings. There's still a ton of big free agents left.
I assume that since the Mets went and got Lindor, that they know something about George Springer that everyone else doesn't know yet. And my assumption is that he'll sign in the next couple of days.
Do you think it's money that they didn't like? Because I just read something on Twitter previously that he wants $175 million.
Which is absurd. I like, George Springer is my favorite player in all of baseball. I wouldn't pay $175 million for George Springer. I'm sorry. But yeah, my guess is the bidding got to a point that they weren't comfortable with, and they said, you know, see ya, we'll go take Frankie Lindor, you know, sign elsewhere.
And yeah, if the Mets are comfortable with that money, then who will be comfortable with it?
I mean, his market's down to Toronto. You know, like, who else is signing him?
Or he can come back home. He can come back home for cheap.
That would make the Astros fans happy for sure. All right, well, I think that's all that we have. Thank you for listening. We are Progressive Development. This was episode 3, covering the major moves in Major League Baseball. You can find us on ProgressiveDevelopmentBSB.com. Turner has stories up on the website. Our third partner, Miles Mensa, who still hasn't joined us for a podcast, has stories up on the website. I've got one up on the website. I'll get more up soon. You can listen to us now on Spotify, working on getting on Apple Music and all of the other listening platforms. And thanks for listening. This is Progressive Development. I'm your host, Grayson Squares. That's Turner Givens. We're out.